The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 252, a paper entitled David O. McKay and the What Air Thou Art, Act Well Thy Part Stone, by Stan Larson, with comments by John L. Needham.
Art, Act Well Thy Part, and then John Allen was the architect, and then it says here 1890,
well, we know it was 1898 that he saw it, and he saw it at the home as it was being built.
So I conjectured that it, well, probably said 1897. You can see it's broken off there. But we'll look at that and see how new information we have can actually verify what that was. But this is the stone that we're talking about, that he tells the story of seeing. And what he says is that when they went to Stirling, they, I'm going to say this according to what he tells in his diary. It's a little bit different than the accounts that he tells. But from his diary, we can tell that on the 25th of March, 1898, they left Glasgow and went to Stirling, and of course had nowhere to go, so they just went to a hotel and stayed the night, paid for their accommodations. And it was the next day, the 26th of March, 1898, that he... both of them went out, start looking for lodgings, and they were quite lucky because they found a very nice place to stay with the Sharp family. And after this was through, the pressure was off. They had their place, and they decided to do a little sightseeing. And Stirling, I want to show you some of the places where he went and where he talks about seeing the old Stirling Bridge, and also the Forth River, which was a very winding river in this area that they went to see a number of the sites. And they spent actually all afternoon doing this, several hours. Probably they spent the most time right in Stirling Castle. Talked about the different, they had guides that would just spend an hour going through and showing the different things. And so he mentions this in his diary as well. Then quite near that, but not right in Stirling, is the Cambus Kenneth Abbey. That all that's left is this bell tower. And the rest of it is deteriorated. And then this one's interesting. This is, you almost have to get out the video of Braveheart and the story of Robert the Bruce and of William Wallace. This is the statue of Robert the Bruce, and you'll notice right there, let's see, right here, there's a little hill, and that's the Wallace Monument that we'll see in a minute. By the way, these illustrations are all taken from not just someone that goes over there today or at a modern reproduction, but pictures that were circulated not right at the time of David O. McKay, but within 3 or 4 years. These are postcards at the turn of the century, old Edwardian postcards of different views. And this is that same little hill there, and there's the Wallace Monument at the top. That was called Abbey Craig. And this shows you, we're getting a little closer now, and so that side of Abbey Craig, this is the Abbey Craig Park, and you can see the Wallace Monument up there. I'd like to divert for just a second, because one of the interesting things that it just shows how what he said in his diary you can confirm, and you can see all this thick foliage and trees and so forth, and we're talking about March of 1898. Well, we have to go along 3 or 4 months to June, where he is called, as young as fresh as that in mission, as conference president, which was all of Scotland. He was over all of Scotland from that point on. And in his diary, he says, realizing to some extent, this is after he got the call, that is to say, a written request from the mission president that he read. realizing to some extent what a responsibility this is. I just seem to be seized with a feeling of gloom and fear, lest in accepting this, I would prove incompetent. I walked to a secret spot in the wood just below Wallace's monument, so somewhere in there, and there dedicated my services to the Lord, imploring him for his divine assistance. So you can see how that little episode, when you see the area, fits with what he's talking about. Then this is a close-up view of that same monument for William Wallace, and he actually went there several times, but this one day is when his first visit to all these places, which would be, that's appropriate, a chance for them to, on the 26th of March, 1898, to go around and see these various places. And he tells about going up the 246 steps to the top and seeing this great panorama view looking out from there. Then, we might want to push that on the bottom. Would you push that on the bottom left? I think that's what we have to do, is hit the, just make it regular. Yeah, with that. So he tells of visiting all these places, and that they had been, he used the word gloomy, and this wasn't the first time that he had, we might just have to get used to the on and off situation here. But it wasn't the first time he talked about being homesick or gloomy or depressed. But certainly they were as they first went to this area, and they had spent these hours, and I think he was a little bit, felt a little bit guilty that they weren't out actually doing missionary work. But at any rate, now this part about seeing it is not in the diary at this point. And we can talk about that a little bit later, but part of the reason is that he tells the physical things that he had seen for the first time at this point in his life, which are the monuments there in Stirling. I don't mind if you don't. So when they finally get here, this is the house that he says he saw a stone that had an interesting inscription. He couldn't read what it was. Now, you'll be the first people to see this because it's not been reproduced elsewhere. This is a lady, so you can get the idea of the size. And there's the door. And he talked about this, the lintel over the door. That's this part here, which I think it says Albany Crescent is the name of this block of apartments. And then here's the room upstairs, and this is the actual stone in the house from that little rectangular area there that he walked up close to and then read it to himself, and says it almost felt like it wasn't just the message that he was reading, but also kind of a reprimand that he needed to do his part well as a missionary and make an internal commitment. And then he told his companion about that. Now that's actually in the house there, and this is a close-up view of that same, a slightly different picture, but a close-up of it, where you can see the stone there. Now you can't see it very well, but in a good reproduction of it, and this is quite poor, these transparencies, you can actually see that the inscription for the date at the bottom right said 1896. So the person who had made the stone did it in 1896, and then it was prepared, I guess, for the plans, and finally it wasn't until 1898, the early March, that they were finishing the house. And what happened, he told the story to a number of people over the years, and especially after becoming president of the church, to missionaries or to groups or even conference talks and so forth. And in 1965, there were a couple missionaries in Stirling who were visiting. They knew about the stone and its story, and they were actually, evidently in this home, though it looks like there is one door, but it's actually a series of apartments in there. And their front room was outside the right so that from the outside to the right of it was the stone. And that's their living room right there. And they were talking to the missionaries and said, well, you know, you can't see us much longer because we have to move. The whole building is going to be demolished. So the missionaries, those two elders, told the mission president, actually they reported it in a meeting and it went to the mission president, who acted very quickly, made arrangements when the demolition crew came to save the stone, and he drove down with his wife and he paid 30 pounds, which would be about $60, $70, for the stone, and then put it and placed it outside the, at this time, that the headquarters were in Edinburgh. So actually, here's a good picture. This is. See, you can see this part here has been broken, and it's only the 18-9 by this, after they got down. There was actually another stone, they didn't buy it, that was on a neighboring house that said something like, arise in thy might or something. But this was the stone that had David O. McKay had talked about. And so there's mission president Phil Jensen, who took these pictures and in his own private collection, and it's interesting to see how that was preserved. And then later, within a couple months, they had it at the mission headquarters here with a brickwork around it, and you can see at this point where it's broken at that point. So that's how the stone got from where it was originally in Stirling over to the headquarters of the mission in Edinburgh. Then, yes?
So,
it wasn't in the Stirling Castle at all. It was after they had spent the afternoon seeing all these places. In fact, remember it said Albany Crescent was the name of the block of houses or flats, apartments. But it was near the castle, and the name of the whole street was Back a Hill Road, which was right to the back side of the Stirling Castle. So it wasn't far. It was sort of how they came back down into the city of Stirling where that occurred. And then, as I say, this was taken to the headquarters of the mission in 1965 and was there for a little over 5 years. And the mission presidency had changed. And what happened? In fact, David O. McKay passed away in 1970. And later in 1970, Markey Peterson, as an apostle, sent the request to have the stone brought to Salt Lake. And he didn't. I mean, when an apostle gives a request like that, the missionaries and the members, and especially the mission president and his wife, didn't really want to let go of it. They thought it belonged there. It had the story was part of Scottish history and wanted it to stay, but the request came, so it was carefully packaged up and sent to Salt Lake, and it went, actually it stayed in several places, and as I said, ended up at the Church Museum of History and Art. And there's a copy, a replica of it at the Missionary Training Center.
Your copy is stuck.
It's what?
Your copy is stuck.
Yes, there actually is. There is a copy now. One of them is, I'm not sure, the least valuable of. There was a third one made, and that one's gone back to Edinburgh in the mission headquarters inside, whereas this is outside, this at that time in 1965. So in 1970, it is actually taken and brought here. Now, the interesting thing about this is that this story that David O. McKay had told a number of times, you know, we can actually see the object, and it was preserved that was that inspiration to it. Now I can't the story about that family, you know, it was outside. You think, boy, they had to join the church. Well, no, that didn't actually happen. As far as the missionary, and I've spoken to him, that one of the two companions, and as far as he knew, you know, they were interested and so forth, but they never joined the church. And so you can't. I mean, that's just the way things are. But still, there's this episode. Provides quite a catalyst for people for understanding, and so that's why it's at the Missionary Training Center even now. Now, one of the other things, I tried this earlier, and I think this will work fairly well, is to people will say, well, what is all this stuff here, these designs and stuff? And there, you notice that there's a lot of geometrical shapes, the triangle and the Roman numeral 2 and, of course, the hand for 5. And as it turns out, if you look at each one of these, now I'll try to set this right on top, about there so you can see. This actually, these 9 pictorial images are a magic square, so that the number represented by each turns out to be 18. If you read across the 3, or up and down, 3 columns, each one of them, or diagonally, the numbers represented on there is 18 in each of those cases. Now, Fred Buchanan here was telling me that he, a while ago, was investigating this and was talking to the person in charge of the church museum, saying, you know, I want to check and see what the relationship here is. I mean, are these Masonic symbols or something? He said, oh, don't, whatever you do, don't find out what that is. We don't want any kind of controversy. And it turns out that though this is called the mathematical relationship of these numbers, and therefore the images that represent those numbers, it's called a magic square. It's not magic, it's just part of mathematics and arithmetic, but that's the way. There's several combinations that can be used, and this one is with 18, and you can get other numbers that also do that same thing. And over the years, various mathematicians have figured out all kinds of versions of that. But this one is, it's more than just some symbols that an artist thought of. There was a meaning behind it. Who knows? I mean, there's a lot of endless possibilities for interpretation, but it is interesting that there is that relationship to the...
you get 9 out of the circle there in the corner.
Well, actually, if you were able to see it, and you can look at it at the church museum, that's a 9-sided nonagon or whatever it is, that's a 9-sided... It looks like a circle down here, but it's actually 9-sided. And so it works out if you consider it. Now, this one here is 2 simply because it's got the Roman numeral 2, and the 10 at the top is the X for 10. So, that.
What was it made of? Was it heavy or was it metal?
No, it's stone, sandstone, I guess. And it's extremely heavy. What?
The stone is gone. The most important stone is the stone of destiny.
Okay. Now, I'd like to mention one last thing that kind of brings this together. It's because he doesn't mention this episode about the stone in his diary. He goes through and talks about the important sites there in Stirling in his diary on that date. And that's what he often did. There are a few places, for various reasons, he talks about how he feels about things, but this one isn't mentioned there. But as it turns out, and this was common, when missionaries would finish their mission anywhere in Great Britain, they would come to Glasgow, and before they had to get on the ship and go home, they'd come a few days early and have some days for sightseeing. And as mission president over all of Scotland, they would come there, and he would often take them on little day trips. And this happened a year later, actually it was about 13 months later, that he was taking one of these elders back to Stirling and showing them sites. Now again, that's not, he mentions that in his diary that he was taking him, but he doesn't talk about this. And then about 3 or 4 weeks later, he's riding home from Glasgow to his sweetheart, Emma Ray Riggs, whom he later marries, and telling her, and he says, and this, we need to read this because this is kind of interesting. And we have the actual letter has been preserved. Her letters to David O. McKay haven't been, but when he wrote to her, she kept them all, and so those have been preserved in the collection. And he said this: "As I read again your letter now before me, a warm feeling of appreciation of your encouraging words comes over me, and your advice, do your work well, will ever be remembered, though perhaps not heeded as it should be. It reminds me," see, now she had said something about, you know, Do a good job. Do your work well. It reminds me of a beautiful inscription carved over the door of one of the cottages in the east part of Stirling. And he gets it exactly right. Whate'er thou art, act well thy part. If one only chooses the good part and does his work well, success and happiness will certainly be his. So, as almost offhanded as she reminds, encourages him, he talks about this episode, and then later it becomes a real, it's a message for everyone to decide what they're going to do in life and whatever it's to be, to do a good job. Now, as I say, each time he does this, tells the story, it's a little bit different. And he mentions in one of them, now you have to choose a noble profession and not an illegal one or something that's bad or morally wrong, but choose a good thing, and that's what you should do well in, which is, I guess, to be understood. So the thing that I find interesting about this is that here we have a chance to look back and see a little bit better what was happening in the mission, and also to have confirming evidences of this particular little story. So it fits in very nicely. Now I'd like to turn the time over to a response, and then we'll have some questions.
Good afternoon. Is it on? Okay. I enjoyed reading Stan's paper. It actually, what I received is a 6-page summary of what he explained here, but I didn't get the visuals, so I lost some of the interesting elements there. But based on what I did read, I've decided to actually go in a different direction in my comments, in my response, than to comment specifically on the historiography of his paper, the sources, and so on. Let me tell you quickly about my graduate study, which will in some sense explain the direction I take my comments. I'm in an American Studies program where we study culture of all forms in all its varieties, whether high art or low pop culture. I've been trained specifically in folklore at USU. There are several folklore scholars and an important archive in the field. I've been trained in history, of course, but not as much as I should be to be able to comment on the historicity of this stone and the incident that Stan has discussed for us. And I've also been trained in literary criticism. So I'm coming at this with ideas that are now being exchanged in the university that are more theoretical, and they may seem a little bit foreign, and I hope I don't lose you, but I'll try to stick to the topic at hand as much as I can. My first remarks are written, and then I'll kind of go from there afterwards. In this 6-page paper, Stan Larson situates McKay's story within the situates McKay's story about the Whate'er Thou Art stone within what he calls Mormon lore. He quotes a dressed-down version of McKay's story, which appeared in Secrets to a Happy Life, the 1960 publication of the non-Mormon publisher Prentice Hall. That's the version he read for us right here at the conclusion that McKay told his wife to be. Is that correct? Upon recounting the story, this is in the paper once again, Larson concludes rather laconically, quote, McKay told and retold this story often during his lifetime. It's in this statement, I believe, that lies the significance of McKay's story about the stone. It is useful to know the details behind it, his encounters with the stone's inscription, which Stan enumerates with care. His account of how the church came to own the original stone, as well as two replicas, is likewise of interest. But to me, McKay's Whate'er Thou Art story is the story, and not so much its provenance or the travels of a stone. What has made McKay's narrative about encountering the Whate'er Thou Art stone so indelible in Mormon culture? I can tell by the gathering here that it has some resonance for many of us here, or you'd be attending 7 other sessions that are available to you right now. As I assume all of us here can attest, it is frequently repeated, even now, years after McKay's passing. This is where the real incongruity comes in of my being the respondent. I was born the year that McKay died, when, in effect, this story, at least its original teller, ceased to live. And yet it has affected my Mormon experience, as I'm sure it has affected many of yours. Continuing the questions I was asking, what elements of the story make it so dynamic, so appealing to the Mormon imagination? Perhaps even more intriguing, will it, as the church continues to grow and internationalize, continue to hold a prominent place among Mormon stories? Lack of time and capacity will prevent my addressing all these questions, but I had to ask them all the same. But I will nevertheless make a few observations on how McKay's story and the axiom behind it have interacted with Mormonism, indeed how they have contributed to the construction of present-day Mormon devotional discourse. Further, I'll speculate on its relation to recent, what some consider, theologically reductionist trends in Mormonism, from the proliferation of general authority devotional books to CTR rings. And I'll try to do it all in 10 or 15 minutes here so that we can have time to question the story further as a group. Like other students in today's world of literary and cultural theory, I've been trained to interrogate artifacts like McKay's story, to contextualize them, to, in the terms of Michel Foucault's Order of Things, trace the genealogy that lends them significance. In my work with Mormon culture, my tendency is to begin by questioning my own relationship as a practicing Mormon with the object under study. So what's my link to McKay's story? During the last 2 months of 1989, I came the closest I probably ever will to knowing how it feels to celebrate a holiday in prison. I spent Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas behind the brick walls of the Provo Missionary Training Center. Though efforts were made to normalize the holidays, to make us feel more at home, each was spent rather dismally engaged in the everyday devotionals and study of MTC life. As I recall, it was near one of those holidays that a visiting general authority narrated McKay's story to an assembly of 2,000-some missionaries. I remember, as a missionary preparing to serve in Europe, paying particular attention to the story's context, knowing that I, too, would soon be gazing on inscriptions and symbols on the buildings of Belgium and France. The version of McKay's story under consideration today makes no reference to the inscription's origins. That is, McKay doesn't refer in the letter to his wife-to-be where it came from, in a sense that, you know, in a historical sense, as I guess he probably didn't know. But as I remember, the version I heard in the MTC linked the "whate'er thou art" axiom to an author or tradition that predated the Mormon Restoration, perhaps a medieval source. Somehow the castle that someone asked about clicked in my mind when I first heard this story. I'm not sure if that was part of what I heard, but in any case, I had a sense that there was a historical source to the inscription. In any event, I don't recall responding to the story in a devotional sense when I first heard it. I just sat there among the other missionaries and took the notes that we were supposed to take. It was only later that it returned to have its desired effect. During one of the holidays that I was in the MTC, I believe it was Thanksgiving, we were directed to go to our classroom, a small room roughly 10 by 12 feet square, to study the missionary discussions and otherwise develop our proselyting skills. Most brought pillows, stationery for letter writing, and the still worldly elders, Calvin and Hobbes cartoon books. Before long, as I endeavored to study amongst the chatter in the classroom, my self-righteousness got the best of me. I could no longer stand the conversations, the talk of cars and girlfriends and the exchange of cartoon books. But just as I was about to let loose on the elders in my classroom, I remembered McKay, the troubled missionary, looking upon the inscription, "Whate'er thou art, act well thy part." I reflected, deciding it was my fate to suffer with, what I considered, the disobedient members of my missionary district. I bit my tongue, found a vacant room down the hall, and with hypocrisy characteristic of the sanctimonious, broke a cardinal missionary rule by spending the day studying alone without my companion. But the story's sway over my missionary imagination didn't end there. Sometime afterwards, still during my stay at the MTC, I encountered the stone's replica in the lobby. This is, of course, one of the two replicas, one at the Scottish Mission Home and then at the MTC in Provo. I remember it having a second residual effect on me, just as, I suspect, it had on others who've gazed upon the stone in one of its three incarnations. Indeed, the sensibility that remained with me during my mission was, I believe, the same which the editors of the Ensign were seeking to enact with the publication in their most recent June issue of a lengthy, largely pictorial, historical survey entitled Preparing for the Restoration, a Great and Marvelous Work. I brought the Ensign, but then lost it en route here. I was going to show you. I'm sure many of you have seen the article. It was, again, in the June issue. It's a 20-page, almost, survey of the history of the Reformation, which pictures everyone from Gutenberg to Tyndale to many other reformers that in the context of the Ensign and in the copy of the article are being appropriated as part of the Mormon story, part of the Restoration. And it has a really convincing effect on the Believing Latter-day Saint reading. It gives you a sense of the providence behind the Restoration in terms of the reformers that came before. Similar to how these images in the Ensign invoke a sense of godly intervention in the Protestant Reformation, the numbering and symbols carved around the "Whate'er thou art" inscription lent a quality of mystery to the stone, to me, as I was looking at it in the MTC. Just like Ensign readers who find in this article a connection with Christian reformers of the past, gazing on the stone, I felt the ancients, Celtics perhaps, calling down through the generations to young Elder McKay as he stood before the stone in Stirling, Scotland. Indeed, I sensed McKay himself extending the call forward to me to act well my part. In my young Mormon imagination, the stone linked me with the moral peoples of the past, with the ancestors of the Europeans among whom I was going to preach, to remind of truths they had lost. That, I propose, is one dynamic to McKay's story. It's linked to the past, to a world that, in our sentimental view of history, offers distinct morality and knightly codes of conduct. It's the axiom's cryptic grammar, its verbal wholeness, that invests it with a sense of transport that it has come down to us from an unknown yet historic past. I don't think you can look at it, at least as a young 19-year-old in the MTC, without a sense of awe that it has come from somewhere historically important. Additionally, I believe the axiom within the stone offers its tellers, from McKay, who told it many times during his lifetime, as Stan points out, to the many who narrated in LDS ward meetings this past Sunday. I'm sure in many of the churches we go to that was told once again this last Sunday, will be told again this Sunday. It offers those who tell it, again McKay and then people telling it today, a rhetorical anchor. The expression, "Whate'er thou art, act well thy part," is like the punchline in a joke, the verbal gesture, the zinger that drives the story home. In rushing to prepare a Sunday school lesson, or when spontaneously addressing a congregation, or in counseling with a troubled youngster, the everyday Mormon can readily attach herself to this story. Its outline is rather simple, but its conclusion holds the turn of a knife required to pierce the Mormon imagination. Once told, this idiom, "Whate'er thou art, act well thy part," anchors the story in its hearer's memory, facilitating recall and retelling. Furthermore, the expression, "Whate'er thou art, act well thy part," lends itself to near universal application. It may be deployed to encourage others in the fulfillment of difficult church callings. A Mormon may call on it to bolster moral instruction in gratitude or accountability. And, of course, by placing the emphasis on the context in which McKay encountered the stone, it functions to inspire a missionary, whether in post-Christian Europe or desolate North Dakota, to embrace his duty. What's more, it's rather benign Mormonness, that it doesn't incorporate any distinct Mormon doctrinal themes, permits its use in secular settings, as in the book from which Larson drew the version we heard today, a publication targeted at a national audience. It, as I indicated earlier, the version that was read to us today appeared in this book, Secrets to a Happy Life, that was published by a non-Mormon press and would have been read by non-Mormons. So again, the story has a universal application in the sense that it's not distinctively Mormon. This story and the expression that drives it, like many that has entered Mormon usage during McKay's that entered Mormon usage during McKay's presidency, represents well a trend in Mormon devotional discourse. Reverential Mormon language, that is, the rhetorical strategies and idioms we employ in church settings to further our religious prerogatives, has for some time been tending toward axioms and similar short quotable statements. Long gone are the days of long-winded, hour-long sermons. Among the conventions of sacrament meeting address and classroom instruction that Mormons have developed in recent decades, perhaps the most omnipresent is the use of the quote. I think we've all heard over the pulpit in recent Sundays someone get up and refer as though it were a commodity, that I have a quote, and this is a great quote. It has almost an objective quality to it. So I'm referring then to the short expression sometimes linked to a story that infuses, even drives, so much of contemporary Mormon religious speak. In fact, it would seem that most who stand before a Mormon congregation take as their theme a quote, a single statement or two words that reflect their theme. Of course, devotional and didactic discourse, Mormon or otherwise, has always depended on axioms and other short one-liners that invoke, in just a few words, a verity or principle. But I speculate it was during McKay's long presidency, at a time when this story and others were aggressively narrated, that the foundations for what I'll call the axiomizing of Mormon discourse were laid. That is, I think it may have been during his near 20-year presidency that we took on these short phrases as a means of expressing our beliefs or ideas as Latter-day Saints. I'm going to try to paraphrase my remaining remarks here. And I think the easiest target I could point to for the proliferation of these idioms and short phrases that we use in our discourse today is correlation, which effectively, according to Armin Moss, Jan Chipps, and others, put an end to doctrinal exploration in official church channels. We stopped having general authorities write books or even speak in general conference on sensitive doctrinal themes. These were pushed to the side, to the wayside, for scholars and other lesser Mormon leaders to wrestle with, while the frontline leaders of the church and those speaking in official settings opted for more moralistic messages, for discussions of how doctrines apply, not how they relate to the cosmos, if you will. So I think then that we can trace back this axiomizing of Mormon discourse to the McKay era when correlation had its beginnings. We'll all, of course, recognize the phrase, every member a missionary. I'm not confident of this, but I'm fairly certain that arose in McKay's era. I know there was a pamphlet I've seen that has that very phrase on it that was circulated in the McKay years. No success can compensate for failure in the home. Not a McKay statement, but we all associate him with it, and it was pronounced many times in his era. These are just two idioms that echo from his time. He also, I think, either coined or at least put stress on the phrase the golden questions or golden question. So again, it was during his time, I believe, that we began reducing our ideas, our beliefs as Latter-day Saints into short catchphrases, even slogans. If we look to the history of Mormon publishing, I've spent 7 of my years at USU subsidizing my studies by working at a local bookstore there, where I've, of course, been involved in the sale of Mormon merchandise. And it's very clear as you look at the history of Mormon publishing that somewhere around the 50s and 60s, general authorities ceased writing, like I said earlier, on sensitive doctrinal themes. I think McConkie's Mormon Doctrine would probably been the last really challenging book in that sense, and turned to more devotional, thought-oriented, inspiring type works. And that's exactly what we look at today as we go to our LDS bookstores. There's a proliferation of these kinds of books. And perhaps it was the search for a good title for these books, those quick little one-liners like Act Well Thy Part, that led to the axiomizing of Mormon religious discourse. But it, of course, has not ended there. It has entered our popular culture with ferocity. The CTR ring that is probably worn by many of us here and that is omnipresent in Mormon culture was rolled out during McKay's administration. It was in 1970, the year he died, that was first given to seven-year-olds who were preparing for baptism. So not only are we reducing our beliefs to quick slogans, but we're also putting them into acronyms of three or four characters. The visit to a LDS bookstore today would, of course, bring you something like this. The cover of this, the most recent issue of Sunstone, shows the kinds of products that you will find in a Mormon-oriented bookstore, which are very iconographic. Lots of images, lots of color, lots of focus on the image, but some use of quick positioning statements and logos and slogans that are verbal but aren't any longer than a few words. My wife has also worked at one of these bookstores with me, and we've speculated that if we would just put aside our studies and formulate the next idiom, like choose the right or what would Jesus do, these things reduced into acronyms, we would probably make ourselves millions, because not only could we market it to Mormons, which now command a large part of the Christian bookselling market, but we could also take it to the Protestants too, as many Mormons are doing. So, what does it all mean as far as this one story is concerned? To me, the question to be considered is, what is the future of this story? What is the future of our remembrance of McKay himself? I think there's reason to suspect that maybe the story will just pass away. Some of us here were alive during his presidency. I wasn't, and will, of course, continue to narrate it and have affection for him as a president. But once we pass on, will the story persist? I would say probably not, at least our remembrance of it, our Mormon remembrance of it. The story, however, offers a couple of features that I think will make it persistent even into the coming century. First of all, it has no geographic fix within the Great Basin, which I'm hearing from Mormons who've lived most of their lives outside of Utah is something that's not really well thought of nowadays. It's resented by non-Great Basin Latter-day Saints when stories are told that are centered in the Great Basin. This story, of course, is localized in Scotland, and so it has an international flair to it, and so it will probably be welcomed in coming decades as the church internationalizes because it has an international source to it. I'd also suspect that the story's lack of Mormon themes, at least it's not even confrontational like a lot of Mormon stories can be, where they're passing on a faith-promoting rumor. The story doesn't really say anything that's distinctively Mormon, so it'll be easy for Mormons to transfer it into the cultures that the church will penetrate. And indeed, I think it connects Mormonism with the wider world, with the history of this country where McKay drew it from, with the effort to understand outside cultures. And those are my remarks on the story. Thank you.
We have just 5 minutes for anybody who has a question, and if you either ask it into this microphone or this one, so we can get it on the tape. Fred, you have something you want to...
It's a brief comment, question. I was district president of Scotland in 1953, and I spent a whole day of my missionary time, and felt guilty about it, trying to find this stone in Stirling with my companion. And we found many homes with similar inscriptions, so they're all over Stirling. And the interesting thing is that it has come full circle, because in 1937, David O. McKay promoted the establishment of the Utah Scottish Pipe Band, Utah Pipe Band. Utah Pipe Band adopted its motto in the 1960s, "Whatever thou art, act well thy part." And out of that, I was the first president of the Utah Scottish Association, and we adopted it as our motto with a twist. I wrote to Inverness, and Her Majesty's Inspector of Gaelic Schools translated it into Gaelic. So today, the Scottish Association presidents take oath of office, whether they're Mormon or not Mormon, on a stone, a Scottish stone, a collection of Scottish rocks, and they say, "Gianach gach nichail," which is the Gaelic for "whatever thou art, act well thy part."
Well, the other question was, those mottos seem to me to be an attempt to lift the people through exposure to classical literature.
Stones, because I suppose I haven't seen the whole thing, but it was either the adjoining building or the other end of it. But as you're saying, these were common, and I guess it was probably to help people, give them little ideas, like you were talking about with
what Mormonism is going through, to have the statement, what every member missionary, and the ten secrets of happiness and other things that David O. McKay was popular with, they were doing that too.
To raise the aspirations of the working class.
Yeah, it happens that part of this, I mean, as you know, when you're trying to find a parallel or a source for an idea, there's a lot of possibilities. But certainly, one big candidate would be Alexander Pope, who was very popular in the 19th century. In his well-known essay on man, the following sentiment occurs, and part of it is exactly the quote. Act well your part, there all the honor lies. So that may have been part of what inspired whoever was working on these buildings in Sterling to choose that as one of these phrases. I'm sure other sources could be found too.
Time for one question. Anybody? Yes. Could you, in the microphone?
Yeah. Let me go. I'll answer this question, then you can do yours. No, I don't think there's ever a place where he says he either aspires to or comments on becoming an apostle or president of the church. When the book comes out in October, for the first time, his patriarchal blessing will be printed in toto. Now, the family, even the children, didn't have his patriarchal blessing. They only had one. His sister wrote a biography, and she included a quotation from part of it. But no one had the copy. So, and I can't ask. You know, someone that's not a descendant can't ask for it. So, I went to Bob McKay, the jeweler in town, and had him request a copy of the patriarchal blessing. 6 months passed; it didn't come. So we did it again, and finally, they both came within a couple of weeks of each other. Both copied. Two copies of the same thing. And then he shared it with the family members who hadn't read the whole thing. But there's nothing in there that's earth-shattering. It's just the usual kind of things about someone preparing. And in this case, he was not preparing for a mission, but it was his father was bishop, and the patriarch came to the home and gave patriarchal blessings to a number of the children. So there's nothing either in that blessing or anywhere in his diary that he expresses any intimation of greatness, but you can see him as a very sensitive and understanding person. Tells a lot of interesting episodes. I must just do one little thing that illustrates, and then we'll have you with your question. One of the things that's difficult, you try to tell it as it is. So there's one episode that was really hard. I could not quite understand why they were doing this, but him and his companion, they said they decided to go to the public baths to look for travelers, and they didn't find any. And so I couldn't understand, well, why would they go to that kind of a place to look for contacts to teach the gospel? Were the travelers ones that were passing through town, or were they homeless people, or what? I couldn't figure it out. But that's what he said. I mean, they went to the public baths looking for travelers and didn't find any. And then months later, going back over, it still didn't seem right. So I went to the trouble of looking in the Oxford English Dictionary, like 20 volumes, 22 volumes or whatever. Huge. And so I look under traveler, and there's column after column, read every possible meaning. And there was nothing that helped. Then the last thing I found in looking at the 4-volume Scottish National Dictionary of just terms that have a specific different interpretation in Scottish or Scots, and it had it, and you'll never, and so it completely changed my whole image of what he was saying, because a traveler is head lice. And so what they did is they went to the public baths looking for travelers, head lice on each other, and didn't find any. So that was a good part of the story, but it was a completely different image than what it sounded like. So obviously that particular statement, that's still his statement, but we've got to have a footnote explaining to people that these travelers are these little things that he was after. Now, would you like to ask your question?
Yes.
It isn't the question. I was just, except it is. President McKay had toured these monuments, as you pointed out. There was Robert the Bruce and Sir William Wallace, the two founders of Scotland, the heroes, the George Washingtons. He saw Stirling Castle there. He showed the bridge, the stone bridge. The King of England was determined to get those rebellious Scots, and incidentally, McKay is a Scotch name, Mac means son of. And William Wallace was waiting on that outcropping onto which the monument sits. The English army and knights, rather than going upstream and ford, decided to go across that stone bridge, which was about two horses wide. When a great number of them had come across, William gave the signal and these men closed the bridge. He came up with his swinging his two-handed 5-foot-long sword and making great room about him, as the story goes. Two English knights got back over the bridge, and it was all. He was later betrayed, of course, hanged, drawn, and quartered for treason. He said he was not, it was not treason. He never had sworn any loyalty to the King of England. It was the King of Norroy Dorry. But if you're Scotch and you go to Stirling, in Stirling Castle, and of course Robert the Bruce, not very far away, surprised them and defeated them a little later. If you've got any patriotism in you, you'll be inspired by that.
This is Lew Wallace, by the way.
Yes, Lew Wallace. And in fact, I have a friend from the Wallace clan who is undertaking to write a history of the Wallace family. So perhaps you have something there that can help him. One comment, John Needham's comment, how long will it last? The memory of this saying, well, Stan Larson hopes a long time, because this October they're going to publish the book, Missionary Diaries of David O. McKay, which will be with that title, and so he hopes it lasts a whole long time.
At least a while.
A lot of sales. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your attention. Your time has been very interesting, and especially appreciate Stan and John.
I have to go share the next set.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.